Welcome to a pre-holiday version of the NPR Movie Podcast, the best of NPR love for the movies. This week, Bob Mondello reviews three films in one review. Benicio del Toro. If you say his name enough, it sounds like you speak Spanish. Benicio del Toro on his latest revolutionary role. John Leguizamo talks about his new holiday film. But first, some of us find the holidays a bit emotionally challenging. Here's something that just might help.
The holidays can be filled with anxiety. There's the traveling, the shopping, the family visits, the layoffs. For those whose families are in trouble, the holidays can be especially difficult. Last year, Amanda Plo of Portland, Maine, devised an unusual, somewhat obsessive way to cope with holiday depression. Her boyfriend, reporter Josh Gleason, recorded the experiment.
Amanda was a freshman in high school when her parents got divorced. But initially, it seemed like the divorce would be a good thing, at least in her mind. The fighting would stop, and everyone would be happier. It wasn't until Christmas Day, when she went to her father's new place for the first time, that she realized things would not be so simple.
The apartment was just very barren. There was a table, but I think the table had, like, folding chairs. It was just really sad to think of my father being there with nothing in his apartment and being away from us. And that was probably when, I lost the Christmas spirit for real.
In other words, Christmas went from being a happy, childlike time to being a dark one. It's been almost 10 years since then, and Amanda says the holiday has never really been the same. But last year, around Thanksgiving, when she noticed that familiar feeling of dread creeping up on her, she decided not to give in. She came up with a plan. In the couple weeks leading up to Christmas, she would watch as many Christmas movies as possible, two or three a night, something she dubbed Christmas movie madness.
All of these movies will have the same idea and hopefully like the same message. And so I'm thinking that maybe, you know, seeing that over and over and over again will help just sort of infuse it into my brain.
But of course there was a risk, one that Amanda was well aware of, that watching a whole slew of movies about happy families experiencing the joy of Christmas could be pretty traumatic.
What if that just reminds me that I didn't have a happy ending to my Christmas? I mean, it could very well depress the crap out of me, but there's only one way to find out.
So Amanda started making her list, checking off as many Christmas movies as she could think of. Miracle on 34th Street, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you get the idea. In the end, it came out to about 20 films.
So we're going for, like, the greatest hits sort of thing here.
Yes, absolutely, the greatest hits.
It got off to a rocky start. The first two films Amanda watched, White Christmas and Love Actually, both brought her to tears.
Are you going to cry in every one of these?
Probably. I feel like the exterior of my emotions has been broken, and now they're just gonna get in deeper and deeper. Maybe it'll get easier.
Things did, in fact, get easier. And as the parade of movies continued, Amanda started to notice a change. She felt less anxious about Christmas. When she went shopping, she didn't get mall rage. And then something even more unexpected happened.
I think I believe in Santa Claus again.
Why?
Some very convincing arguments in these movies that we've seen.
Every one of these letters is addressed to Santa Claus. The post office has delivered them. Therefore, the post office department, a branch of the federal government, recognizes this man, Kris Kringle, to be the one and only Santa Claus.
I don't really believe in Santa, although I want to believe in Santa right now. In fact, sometimes when I'm trying to fall asleep, I'll sort of think I hear sleigh bells, even though I know that there are none, but I think that I kind of hear them. Like, oh my God, are those sleigh bells? Oh my God, I've got the Christmas spirit.
Nevertheless, despite Amanda's newfound belief in Santa Claus, the movies didn't do what they were supposed to. They didn't wipe out her bad memory of Christmas past. By the time the credits rolled on the obvious finale, It's a Wonderful Life, that feeling, her feeling of dread about spending Christmas with her family, it hadn't gone away.
I don't think there was any major change. I don't know. Honestly, they're just movies. I mean, I watched a lot of them, and I cried a few times, and I laughed a few times, and maybe I was thinking that I could fix my Christmas, but how do I fix my family's Christmas? I don't think that this Christmas is going to be very much different.
When Christmas Day finally came, Amanda gathered with her mom, her sister, her nephew, and me. And it went pretty well, better than she expected. As gifts were exchanged, there wasn't any sense of sadness or bad feelings. Everyone seemed happy.
I don't think it's necessarily a coincidence that I had the best Christmas in recent memory and I spent all this time watching movies, but also we talked about my past Christmases and Christmas Movie Madness a lot, so maybe talking about my feelings was more therapeutic than the movies themselves.
Of course, asking a bunch of movies to help fix a holiday marred by a bad childhood memory is asking a lot. So in the end, it's not surprising that what Amanda needed to fix her Christmas wasn't Hollywood. It was just someone to talk to about how Christmas went wrong for her and how she's trying to make it better. For NPR News, I'm Josh Gleason.
Three movies open this week, all angling for Oscars. The Reader is about Germany's Nazi past, Gran Torino is about a war veteran who hates immigrants, and Doubt is about a church scandal. So you might think these movies have nothing in common, but Bob Mondello says all three are about generational divides.
Two of these movies have plots revolving around sex between an adult and an adolescent. In Doubt, about a nun who suspects a priest of molesting an altar boy, absolutely nothing sexual happens on screen. And even without sex, Doubt turns out to be more about sex than The Reader, in which a 15-year-old German boy spends the summer of 1958 romping in bed with his 36-year-old girlfriend. Erotic antics are more or less beside the point in The Reader, even when the reading is going on in a shared bathtub.
Lady Chatterley felt his naked flesh against her.
This is disgusting. Where did you get this?
Borrowed it from someone at school.
Well, you should be ashamed. Go on.
The Reader treats young Michael as a sex-crazed puppy eager for experience. It does not treat Hannah as particularly exploitive, though she clearly is exploitive, because what the Reader has on its mind isn't their physical relationship, but the generational change they represent in Germany. Michael is part of what's known as the German second generation. He was born toward the end of World War II and grew up innocently, only learning of Nazi crimes against humanity as he matured. Hannah lived those crimes, and that, far more than the criminal act of her taking an underage lover, is what makes their intimacy grotesque. Doubt is also about a generational difference, not so much between priest and altar boy, though that's certainly the topic of a lot of conversation, but between priest and nun. Young Father Flynn, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, represents the winds of doctrinal change that are blowing through the Catholic Church in the 1960s, winds that alarm Sister Aloysius, played by Meryl Streep. She resists change, whether it's those newfangled ballpoint pens that are messing up penmanship, or the very idea of singing a non-religious song at a Christmas pageant.
Frosty the Snowman espouses a pagan belief in magic. If the music were more somber, people would realize the images are disturbing and the song heretical. Should be banned from the airwaves.
So, not Frosty the Snowman.
May I ask what you're writing down with that ballpoint pen?
Oh, nothing. It's an idea for a sermon.
What is the idea?
Intolerance.
The laid-back priest seems far more appealing than the closed-minded nun until she wonders aloud, without offering any evidence, what's going on between him and an altar boy. Nothing, he says, but it's hard to prove a negative, which leads, as the title has it, to doubt. What connects Doubt and The Reader is a shared notion that the old ways, whether old church or old Germany, were intolerant, even monstrous. But the espousers of the new are damaged, compromised, and not necessarily better guides to morality. Our elders are disasters, these movies say, and so are we. Now, what are we going to do about our children? One answer is suggested by Clint Eastwood in his new film, Gran Torino. He's playing a guy who is sort of a geriatric Dirty Harry, a racist, bitter old coot who can't stand the Hmong immigrants who've taken over his neighborhood. Then he gets in the middle of a gang dispute and inadvertently helps them, at which point they start stacking flowers on his front porch.
Look, why are you bringing me all this garbage anyway?
Because you saved Tao.
I didn't save anybody.
You're a hero to the neighborhood.
I'm not a hero.
Too bad they think you are.
What he really is something these Hmong families feel they've lost. They've developed generational issues themselves in resettling here. Distant kids, rootless families. Eastwood's character reluctantly becomes for his Hmong neighbors what our society once respected and what theirs still does. The wise, protective elder, capable of routing gangs and of knowing instinctively what's right. Now, if only it were that easy outside the Cineplex. I'm Bob Mondello.
Actor Benicio del Toro wanted to play the role of Che Guevara for years. He first heard of the legendary Argentine revolutionary when he was a kid growing up in Puerto Rico.
The very first time I heard his name probably was from a Rolling Stones song called Little Indian Girl.
It's the gringo. My father, he ain't no Che Guevara.
That Rolling Stones song didn't really explain much about the Marxist leader, but it did conjure an image in Del Toro's mind. He thought that Che Guevara sounded like a pretty cool guy.
A warrior, not necessarily a killer, like a serial killer, but a warrior, a revolutionary, a man with a weapon, a man. That was the image that I had.
Benicio del Toro recently brought that image to life in the film Che, directed by Steven Soderbergh. It opens this week in New York and Los Angeles, presented as two films with an intermission in between. The second film looks at Che Guevara's failed attempts to start a revolution in Bolivia. The first chronicles his time in Cuba, where he fought under the leadership of Fidel Castro. The film is mostly in Spanish, except for a few scenes where Che Guevara is interviewed through an interpreter.
What is the most important quality for a revolutionary to possess?
El amor.
Love.
Love.
Déjeme decirle algo.
Let me tell you something, at the risk of sounding ridiculous. A true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. Love of humanity, of justice and truth. It is impossible to conceive of an authentic revolutionary without this one quality.
Benicio del Toro won the Best Actor Prize at Cannes this year for his portrayal of Che Guevara. When I spoke with him earlier, he said he did a lot of research for the role, starting with a book he picked up in Mexico City.
The book was a collection of letters he had written to his mother, to his aunt, to his father. And I saw this other side of him. His writing, number one, was really fantastic, and it had some kind of wisdom. It had some social conscience, it had some wit, self-criticism, it had a sense of humor. There was this other image that started to emerge, because I didn't know much about the guy, but that little thing from a Rolling Stones song, so I got more interested in him.
This film is a really long film. It's about 4.5 hours.
It's not that long.
It's pretty long.
It's not even a flight from, L.A. to New York.
I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
Some change. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting about it is here you have this whole stretch of time, and you see so much about what happens in his life, but a lot of it's action, and you don't get those kind of pivotal scenes where you find out why it is that he makes the choices that he makes. So I'm curious, what did you as an actor bring into this role to kind of help inform you? Why did he take each of these steps along the way? Why did he make these decisions he made?
Some of it, in movies as an actor, you just look out for the background of the character and the history of Latin America, in a way. If you think about it, it's just a history of a lot of violence and a lot of, like, colonialism or man exploiting man. And so he emerges from that. So what I do as an actor is to learn some of the history, and in a way the movie is not trying to explain it, it's just peeping into these moments of his life.
One of the themes of this film had to do with the fact that Che Guevara was from Argentina, and here he was fighting in Cuba, fighting in Bolivia, countries that weren't his own. You yourself were born in Puerto Rico, but you spent most of your life in the United States. Was there anything about your own personal experience that you were able to draw on?
Yeah, I mean, being Puerto Rican, Puerto Rico and Cuba share a lot of its history. Prior the turn of the century of the 1900s, Cuba and Puerto Rico were both colonies of Spain, both fighting for their independence. So,
this is a film that's primarily in Spanish, and that was your native language, but most of your recent films have been in English. What was that like for
all
you switching
games? Not most of my recent films. All my films have been in English. So, yeah, it's more complicated than you think.
How so?
You are listening to yourself speaking Spanish. I spoke more Spanish in this movie than I've spoken in maybe the last 20 years in one sitting. You know, I live in Los Angeles. I dream in English.
I'd like to ask you about the image of Che Guevara, which is one that's been seen so often here in the U.S., most often on T-shirts, on college students. I just the other day saw a Che Guevara beer, and it seems like he's almost become an icon removed. A beer, Che Guevara beer.
Where? What was it called?
I think it was called Che. But I just wonder, I mean, he's just become so much of an icon in this country. What role do you see Che Guevara serving in today's American modern culture?
Whoa. What do you think? Whoa, I think that, I don't know. I think he's pretty well known all over the world when it comes to his image. And I think that in my experience of the people that I've known that wear a T-shirt of Che, is that they know something about him, an essence. Either this guy didn't sell out, this guy followed his dreams all the way to the end, you know, this guy never quit, this guy fought for injustice, or something that maybe is not the whole picture of Che, but there are, I think, elements about Che that are in a way real.
Benicio del Toro plays Che Guevara in the new film Che. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
for what you do.
Sure thing. Our pleasure. Bye-bye. Bye.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. December is the month for Hollywood's feel-good films, many of which follow a recipe as familiar as Grandma's sugar cookies, but for some people, just as stale by January. Nothing Like the Holidays is a variation on that theme, but with a twist. Yes, it's a movie about the kids and assorted others returning to the family homestead, maybe for the last time. And it also tackles traditional themes like the conflict between the generations over what the kids want versus what the parents want for them. But the film also takes the plunge into such up-to-the-minute issues like the war in Iraq and what it means to be Latino today. Joining us to talk about the movie and also where this film fits into his very rich and diverse career is one of the stars of the film, John Leguizamo. Mr. Leguizamo, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
A pleasure, Michelle. I love being on NPR. It's my favorite radio network.
Oh, I'm so glad.
In the world.
Well, I was going to start by saying I've seen everything you've done, but then I thought, let me check. I'm not sure you've seen everything you've done.
I try not to see everything I've done.
Well, something like 80, almost 80 film roles, 5 Golden Globe Awards, an Emmy, theater. But anyway, your work is identified, I think, with a certain edge, whether it's your ongoing work on ER, maybe Romeo and Juliet. What made you want to do this film?
Well, I feel like we've never had a really successful all-Latin film. And it's something that everyone's trying to break because we know we got the audience out there. We know we got the money out there, the Latin audience and crossover audience. It's just, what is that cinema piece going to look like? And I think this might be it. You know, it needs to have a commercial value because Latin people, you know, in general, there's a lot of drama. So I know Latin people don't really want a harsh movie. They want to see an action film, or they want to see a comedy. They want to see something that can get away from their lives. And I think this movie captures that. It's funny, it's complex, and it's real, and it's fun.
Tell me a little bit about your character, Mauricio. I bet you he's somebody a lot of people can relate to.
He's born blue collar Puerto Rican in Chicago, moved away to be successful, which his parents wanted him to be. He goes to New York to become a lawyer, high powered, marries this very successful investment banker. She happens to be white. She happens to be Jewish. And he comes home after 3 years of being away. And, you know, he's getting older, so is his parents, and he comes back. And the typical thing, I think it happens in every ethnic group and race and religion, is that if you have parents who are blue-collar and they want you to be very successful, and you are that, then there's that fear that they think that you're better than them now that you are very successful. And it creates conflict in the movie, which I loved because I felt it was so real. You know, here I am coming back expecting parades and all that. I get none. And the dad loves my younger brother better. Well, I feel he does. So it creates this competition between me and my younger brother.
And I think the reason a lot of people can relate to this is that, just as you said, you know, on the one hand, he's done everything his parents wanted for him. On the other hand, now everybody's afraid he's turned into somebody that they don't recognize anymore. And then I want to play a short clip from the film. And in some ways, it feels like he's an outsider in the family. But in some ways, he's very traditional. And this is a clip from where your character, he's talking with his brother and sister in the film,
right.
They've just learned that their parents are talking about getting a divorce after more than 30 years of marriage. Here it is.
You know what you sound like? You sound like people who aren't married. That's what you sound like, okay? Because let me tell you about marriage, all right? Sometimes you're in it, you feel like you don't want the same things anymore. And you start going at each other, and you go at each other, and you go at each other. But you stick it through. And at the end of that, you fall in love all over again, and that's marriage, okay? So don't tell me that mom and dad, after doing that all these years, don't got a little bit of love left for each other, okay? Because I'm not buying that.
We like that clip because it seems like Hollywood these days, you know, marriage isn't the most popular institution. It's played for laughs. Also, oftentimes I think the biracial or bicultural relationships are played for laughs. Do you think this film adds something to that, that's not just the punchline?
Right, right. I mean, which is trippy about making a movie like this is, how do you still make a funny movie and still have meaning and still make it deep and still get the laughs? And I think it's possible. I mean, you got to work extra hard. And it's what I've always tried to achieve in my work, is that I think you can do really dark pieces, really meaningful, really powerful, and still be hilarious. It doesn't have to turn into like a silly joke or just goofy. You can put real meaning into things. And that's always been my struggle in life with Hollywood. And in this movie, I found that we had the complexity of those issues, and we still had the hilarity.
How do you work that balance, though? Because on the one hand, you do want to explore the culture. I think one of the things that I think some people will find fun about this film is that you get the Puerto Rican culture. I mean, some people are kind of funny with it, like they have the flags and the coquito that they're serving at the holiday meal. You do get the culture. On the one hand, you don't, as an artist, want to be put into a box. How do you work that when you're choosing?
I don't mind being put into a box. I have no problems being a Latin man. You know, I mean, I embrace that with everything that God has given to me, that my culture has given to me. That's not the problem. The problem is bad portrayals and sort of a negative spin on who we are and an inappropriate take on who we are. You know, that's the problem. I always want to be a Latin man. You know, I played Toulouse-Lautrec in Moulin Rouge. I'm light-skinned, so I can get away with it. I can pass sometimes, you know, in some circumstances. And some of my other Latin colleagues aren't as light-skinned, so it's harder to pass, you know, but I'm fine playing a Latin man.
But the reason I brought that up is that does not seem to have happened to you. Although I do say that there are some of the actors in this film, I bet you they're glad to have a role where they don't have a knife in their hand.
I mean, at the beginning of my career, that was the case. I mean, when I started acting in the late 80s, I mean, that's all that was offered to you. I mean, I went to NYU. I studied with some of the great acting teachers, and everything that was offered to me was killer, gangbanger, or you were just incredibly subservient without any dimensions. And that's what was offered to you. That's why I started to write my own stuff, because I just felt like I don't need to be demeaned like this. I work too hard to have to do this to myself or to my people. I just want roles that represent the experiences that I have had.
You're also a woolly mammoth in Ice Age, right, too?
Yeah, Sid. The Sloth. This is true.
The Sloth. And yeah, you were also a voiceover for a video game.
Coming up, yeah. Right?
And you're a ringtone.
I'm a ringtone.
Yeah,
I'm
you know, you
ringtone.
Can. Do you know? Yes, you can.
Oh, I'm a Sid the Sloth
John
ringtone.
I'm a ringtone. Did you know that you can?
No,
download
not my
yourself?
Voice, but I'm a character, right? Well, I better see some pay off of that. I want to see some royalties. Then I'm calling my lawyer after this talk.
You can hear these stories and more on our website, npr.org/movies.